Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Okay, welcome to Nature Biotechnology's First Rounders podcast. My name is Brady Huggett, and I am the host of this show. And the guest today is Ted Love. I first spoke to Ted Love at length about 3 years ago. I interviewed him for our piece on racial disparity in biotech, and he was a great source for me in that article. And I did a photo shoot with him. He was a lead image for the article. And ever since then, I put him on the list for First Rounders because I thought I'd really like the chance to get his full background and talk about his path through science and what it took to succeed at Haverford and Yale as he did. And given what is happening in my country, our country, Ted's country and my country, I thought maybe now is the time to do it. And so I reached out and said, is Ted willing to do this? Let's talk about his past and let's see if we can have a useful conversation on race, as useful as we possibly can. And he said, yeah, he wanted to do it. So that's what this is. We set up a video call because we're still not doing things face to face. And we sat down and talked about him growing up in Huntsville, Alabama, him going to Haverford, a small liberal arts private school where the students were mostly white, him going to Yale. We talked about why, in some ways, he thinks the company that he helms, Global Blood Therapeutics, is a social justice company. And we talked about a bunch more. We talked about race as a construct. We talked about police brutality. And yeah, let's just get into it. I think all these that I put out are good, or I wouldn't put them out, but I found this useful in ways that maybe other conversations weren't. I don't know. I hope Ted feels the same. Anyway, here it is, your First Rounders podcast with Ted Love. Listen up. So anyway, it's good to see you. How are you doing?
It's good to see you. I'm doing very well. It's good to talk to you again.
So I, you know, generally these kind of focus on a person's path through science, right? How they made their way from science, usually into the industry side. That's kind of the tie that holds this whole show together. Yeah. And so I want to do that with you. And, you know, you and I have talked about some of this in the past, but I think the best way to start is, you know, how did you grow up and how did you get interested in science?
So, as you know, I grew up on a farm in Alabama. There were 8 kids, so there were 10 people living in a very, very small home. There was actually a girls' room and a boys' room. So we had 5 boys sleeping in one room and 3 girls in the other room. And my parents had the third bedroom in our house.
Yeah.
My family also was not a family with a lot of educational background. Neither of my parents completed high school. But I would say this: my family was very much a family of love and support, and stability, and hard work, and discipline also. And I actually became interested in science because, number one, I liked it. I really liked science and I really liked math. And I had a natural, it appears, skill at that.
Yeah.
And I was also struck by my family doctor. You know, he was somebody that everybody admired. And he seemed to have a different lifestyle than we had. He certainly did. So it kind of was a nice combination of things for me that I like science. I like math. I thought that could position me one day to become a doctor. And our family doctor was really the only person of color that I was around that was so respected and admired and also had a good lifestyle.
Yeah. So in these eight kids, where do you fall in that lineup?
I am, if you count down, I would be number six. So I have a younger brother and a younger sister.
Near the bottom then. Okay. So you lived on this farm. Your parents were farmers.
Well, my father actually worked on Redstone Arsenal. That was where he really made a living. But we had about a 20-acre farm that we farmed. And that was something that I grew up working along with my brothers, particularly my brothers, and my father also worked. But my father worked on the Arsenal full time.
I'm sorry, where did he work?
He worked on Redstone Arsenal. You've heard of the Redstone rockets for the space program. Those rockets were made on Redstone Arsenal.
Oh, so that's right. I forgot this. You grew up in Huntsville.
That's correct. Absolutely.
Okay. So that's why your family was there for this job.
Well, my mother grew up, was born and grew up in Scottsboro, Alabama, which is about 50 miles north of Huntsville, north of Huntsville. Yeah, about north of Huntsville, 50 miles. My father was born and raised in Huntsville. And it actually turns out my grandfather had been a very successful farmer and for a black man, I think, had been fairly wealthy. So when he died, all of the children, and he had about 10 kids, I believe, all of the kids inherited 20 acres of land. So he was a fairly wealthy person. Unfortunately, what was very characteristic happened to him, though, when black people would die in the South, they were typically represented by white lawyers, because all lawyers were white. Their wealth never really got very efficiently translated. My father was probably entitled to a lot more than 20 acres, but that's what he got. And that's what all of his siblings got.
So you mean the lawyer would skim off the top?
Yeah.
So instead of everybody getting 30 acres, you might each get 20, and then the lawyer somehow got 20 acres out of it, that kind of thing?
I don't know how it worked, but it was always clear to me that my grandfather had really amassed a significant amount of wealth for a black man. And when it got distributed, it was only really enough for the kids to get 20 acres.
I see. Yeah. So the family's looking around like, it used to be more here. And for some reason, it's not quite as much as it was before the lawyer got a hold of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it safe to say that your dad decided he didn't want to be a farmer? He's like, I'm not going to do that life. I'm going to do something else.
I wouldn't say that. My father ended up in the military, like a lot of people his age. And after the military, he ended up getting a job working on the arsenal because it was a way to support his family. The farm really didn't support us. My father's job on the arsenal supported. He just worked in a warehouse. He was a person who moved things around and place things and recover things from a big warehouse. He only had a fourth grade education, so he did not have one of the kind of jobs where they were actually working on the rockets. He was really working in a warehouse.
But your family used the farm just to produce food for yourself.
We did. We had big gardens. Big gardens, so that way we were able to feed ourselves. But we also had cattle and we had pigs, so we would generate a lot of our own food, but we didn't really produce enough on that farm to support the whole family. We were growing enough corn to feed our animals, but not really sell it. We were growing enough hay to generally feed our animals, but not really sell it. We never really got into cotton. The cotton that I picked for money.
Yeah. Yeah. So was your father's job, did that open your mind to, I mean, did you ever consider like, well, maybe I want to go into space or astronaut or anything like that?
Never thought about astronaut. I did think about engineering. Engineering was probably the only thing that I ever remotely considered. And again, that fit with my interest in math and science. But medicine was always something that I was more drawn to emotionally. Engineering was probably a backup, if you will, because I certainly wasn't sure if I'd be able to get into medical school as a kid. So I think engineering was kind of a backup career option.
But so your plan the whole way was medical school when you were young.
It was. I mean, in fact, I think my nickname became Dr. Love when I was probably about 10.
Okay, so I mean, yeah, I know that you went to Haverford for college, but as you're going through school, are you thinking like, how do I, you know, are my grades good enough? Am I going to be able to get into medical school one day? What colleges were you thinking about? You know, what was your process?
Well, it was interesting in that I went to a big public high school, and very few kids from my high school would end up at Ivy League schools. In fact, it really wasn't a school that was geared toward that. So the way I went about colleges was very much the way I went about a lot of things. I went to the library, I got books on colleges, I read them. And I decided to focus on the best places to get an education in the country. And of course, I wasn't sure where I'd get in. So I applied to the usual Ivy Leagues, the Harvard, the Yales, et cetera. But I also applied to outstanding smaller schools like Haverford, like Pomona, like Oberlin. And in the end, I decided to go to Haverford. I didn't get in everywhere either, by the way. But I did better than I thought I might do. And I was thrilled that I got into Haverford, both at the moment and also at this point in my life, because it ended up being an exceptional place for someone like me who really wasn't as prepared as I might have been had I gone to stronger schools. It allowed me to really make the transition and become highly competitive with my classmates because of the kind of individual nature of the education that I got there.
But when so when you finished high school, you had great grades, I'm assuming. If you're thinking about Harvard, you think about Ivy League, you must have done well.
I did. I had very good grades. I was also a leader. I was also an athlete. So I kind of had a lot of things going for me. The thing that was the hardest was the standardized test. I ended up doing okay. I did probably extremely well for somebody from my background, but I wasn't a superstar in terms of SAT when I started to be compared to a lot of the people that Haverford recruits from, particularly private schools.
Okay, so I'm just curious, what sports?
I mostly, in the end, I was a wrestler. I started out playing football and basketball, but you know me, and I'm about 5'6". So eventually, it became a big disadvantage, no matter how determined I was, as you know, people got bigger and bigger and bigger for me to be super competitive. So I dropped back to wrestling, where it was really based on weight.
I mean, I think wrestling is such a there's such a community of wrestlers. I mean, it's when you meet another wrestler, you automatically know what that sport is. It's unique, no? I've always felt that way.
It's very unique. It's an individual sport, but you're on a team. So I loved it because I loved my teammates and I loved us trying to win as a team. But fundamentally, when you get on the mat, it's you and another person. And the thing I would tell to people, you either get your butt kicked or you win. And so you go out there to win. And I was particularly excited to not get my butt kicked when I went out there.
Were you good?
I was pretty good.
Yeah, I could tell. All right, I was thinking about this today, this sort of you going to Haverford, and this must have been this was a jump on many levels, right? Like you weren't going from the south to the north. Probably a jump in class, right? I mean, I'm assuming there are a lot of more affluent people at this school. It's going to be a jump in race on top of that. And then fourth, it's like I think if we're counting your parents, you've been like first to college, which is a whole nother level of anxiety. I don't mean you and your family, but your parents had not gone to college. So now you're sort of like this next level. Yeah. And all of that must have been rolled into that, you know, you first arriving on that campus.
It was a completely different experience. I'd only actually been on one airplane my whole life up until then. It was a high school trip to the Bahamas where we actually went on a prop plane that we picked up in Florida. We drove to Florida, Fort Lauderdale, I believe, and then we hopped on a little prop plane and we flew over to the Bahamas. So that's the only plane I'd been on until I caught that plane to college. And I will tell you that it was a brutal arrival in that Haverford students in the Haverford van came to the airport to pick me up. And I'll never forget that my bags came down the conveyor. And when they hit the wall of the carousel, they exploded open. You know, these were old bags that were cheap. And my clothes just kind of flew everywhere. And I was standing there embarrassed by these kids were picking me up. And I automatically felt like, boy, I don't belong. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, just to give you how naive I was wearing a suit. My mother wanted me to look good when I went to college. And so we went to JCPenney and we bought a Johnny Carson suit. I remember this. And I was wearing my Johnny Carson suit when I landed in the hot, muggy Philadelphia airports, sweating, and my bags exploded.
First off, I didn't know that Johnny Carson had a line of suit, number one.
It was cheap, I'm sure.
And two, just, you know, the concept of like, oh, this, that, you know, you come to pick up your bags and there was like, this kid's going to school. Look at him. He's got his suit on for school. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But I mean, you know, cause we've talked before, you end up doing really well at Haverford. You made all the adjustments that are required to overcome all those things.
I did. I had a fantastic time at Haverford. I would say that, you know, it's interesting to talk about this during the whole kind of racial catharsis that we're going through in the United States right now. Just if I reflect back on Haverford, it was really a place where I felt the emphasis was really about me. It wasn't about anything else. But it wasn't colorblind, by the way. Nobody was trying to focus on colorblindness. I was being accepted for who I was. I was being embraced for who I was. I had some limitations when I went there. In fact, my English teacher told me that I was identified in advance as someone who might have difficulty passing the first course that was required. And about halfway through the course, she told me that. And she said, I got to tell you, I'm impressed at how hard you work and how well you're doing. Now, I didn't get an A. There were kids that were really, really gifted, and they got the A. But I don't know what I got, but I did better than she expected. And yeah. I continued to do better and better as the semesters passed.
But they had identified you for all those reasons we just mentioned, that you were coming from a black community to a white one, that you've been first to college in your family, that sort of thing. And they thought, this is a person who's going to need extra attention.
That's right. And so they brought me there with a understanding and a commitment to deliver on that. And that was extremely apparent to me early on, but it wasn't, the funny thing about it, I think that it was all in this belief that this guy can do extraordinary things, but we've got to get him up to speed. And there was a commitment to get him up to speed. And one of the things I can tell you about me, and this helped me in wrestling, is that I don't give up, and I'm very determined. So when you put someone like me in an environment that wants to help me, then there's a lot of work going on, and there's a lot of commitment to succeed. And I was committed to succeed for all the people that were trying to help me to succeed.
Yeah, both at home and at the school.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, you just said this thing I thought was interesting. You said that the school wasn't colorblind in any way, and you're accepted for who you were. What do you mean by colorblindness? Well,
many of the Ivy League schools, including these small kind of Ivy-like schools like Haverford, Swarthmore, et cetera, had gone through a situation in the 70s where they brought in a fairly large number of African-American students. And I've met many students from that era, and it was very bad. It was very traumatic for those students, and it was very traumatic for those schools. And I think fundamentally what many of them learned is that if you bring these individuals here, you need to make the environment welcome them rather than expect them to assimilate. So Haverford wasn't trying to get me to assimilate. I obviously changed when I was there, but I was not assimilating. I did switch over from wearing suits to wearing jeans and to wearing khakis. That was actually more comfortable. But I never even remotely stopped acting the way I am fundamentally. I never began to express my views about anything any differently. I never assimilated.
I see. So the other schools have been like, hey, we're allowing African-Americans into this university now, but we're not changing a thing about it. You come in and fit in or get out, versus
Haverford's right.
Like, listen, we are going to let you in, not let you in, but invite you in and also make sure that we actually support you.
Yeah. And I think the school actually wanted that. And I ended up being, you know, Haverford was about 3% Black students. So we were minuscule terms of the population. It's a small school to begin with, so you're talking small numbers and small percentages. And I ended up being the first African-American president of student body. And the reason that happened, I think, is because I was very authentic all the time. And I think people never wondered about where I was coming from. Never worried about my motivations, my intent. And that, I think, ended up being something that we all grew into. So I kind of grew up at Haverford. I grew up with Haverford. And not that everything was perfect. I don't want to suggest that.
Yeah.
But it was a life-changing experience. And I can tell you, even now, I occasionally get a letter from someone in my class who I don't even remember necessarily, who would say to me things like, I follow what you're doing in biotechnology, and none of this is a surprise to me, having known you at Haverford. And, you know, it's just amazing to get these letters, because when I was there, I was trying to figure out, how am I going to get good enough grades? How am I going to get through? You know, for me, it was just an experience, but it's very clear in retrospect that many of my classmates were looking at me as somebody that they were looking up to, which I had no idea of.
Yeah, they expected you to do well. Yeah.
Yep.
You told me this before, and I never forgot it. You said that when you first got to Haverford, you had a little bit of racial anxiety. You know, am I going to be able to compete at this level? But by the time you left, that had been obliterated.
That had been obliterated. The main thing that I learned at Haverford early on is how to study. I'd never been in an environment where the academics were so intense. And I'd been able to essentially get over all my career because I was pretty good. But at Haverford, the bar was just so much higher. And I didn't really know how to study. And ironically, my chemistry professor ended up being the one who gave me the lectures, you know, about this is how you study. This is how your memory decays. This is how you rewrite your notes. I mean, and I took notes on how he told me how to study. And by the time I left Haverford, I was very well trained to go about studying. And that was a great, great background for going into medical school at Yale.
Can I ask you, like, in high school, you didn't really need to study, did you? You just got good grades.
You know, I studied, but I didn't study. I didn't have great techniques, but I didn't need them. I could still get A's without great techniques. But at Haverford, to really be competing at that level and to try to be in the top, 20% of the class, I needed to get the best techniques, which I didn't know.
Yeah. Okay. So you make all this growth in 4 years and you leave, you're still thinking medical school, right? You're like, I'm going to be a doctor. That's still your plan.
Oh yeah. No, I never gave up on that. I was worried my first semester, but after my first semester, I think it looked realistic that I would get into medical school.
Yeah. So then you went to Yale.
I went to Yale.
Yeah.
Which is a great medical school, as you know.
Yeah. So what was the thinking there? Were you thinking, okay, this is it. I'm on my way to being a doctor. I'm going to open a practice one day That was it.
I mean, my intent in going into medicine in the beginning was just about becoming a physician and really doing what my family doctor did, likely go back to Alabama and provide medical care to people from my community. That's how I thought about it in the beginning. Of course, it ended up evolving very differently, but that's pretty much the way I thought until I was well into my career at Yale and people began to say to me that I should think about an academic career.
Were you a professor before Genentech came calling?
I was, but very junior. So after Yale, of course, I went to the Mass General where I did my
training. Your residency, right?
Yeah. I did my internship residency and fellowship in cardiology. And then after all of that, I was invited to join the faculty. So I did join the faculty and then I was recruited by Genentech.
Okay. So tell me about that. I mean, had you really considered the biotech industry? Did you even really kind of know?
I had no idea what biotech was. And what happened to me was that I was head down focused on becoming an academic. Of course, I always set goals and my goal was to become a full professor at Harvard one day. And at the time, I don't think an African-American had ever achieved that. So I was particularly focused on doing that. And my mentor, who was head of cardiology, got recruited out of Harvard and became president of R&D for Bristol-Myers Squibb. And he and I, he was really like a second father to me. My father died when I was at the Mass General, and Ed, ultimately became not only my mentor in science and medicine, but almost like a second father. So it was through conversations with Ed that I began to think about doing something perhaps different than an academic career. And then I looked at Bristol-Myers Squibb, but I also looked at these companies called biotech companies. And Genentech was really quite an extraordinary company in terms of science and just the overall pedigree. And ultimately, I actually looked at taking a job at Merck, which is really an extraordinary company that I admire at the time, run by Roy Vagelos, who I have great admiration for and consider him my friend today. And Genentech. And to give you the analogy, I actually decided that Merck was like Harvard, big, excellent, and Genentech was like Haverford, small but excellent.
Yeah.
And I decided to go to small and excellent because I thought that'd be a better environment for me to learn quickly and the broad business of how do you discover and develop drugs. And I think that ended up being a good decision, although I'm sure Merck would have been terrific as well. Genentech was remarkable. It was a remarkable place. It was fairly small when I went there. So we did everything. I would do everything from talk to scientists in the lab about experiments that they were doing to dealing with the Food and Drug Administration, designing trials, clinical investigators around the world. I got a very broad experience there, which was not really achievable at a bigger company.
Right. So Genentech is this introduction to biotech for you. And it begins this sort of career where you move from there to Theravance, I think.
I did. I moved from Theravance. And again, Roy Vagelos called me. So Roy had retired from Merck. And he was one of the founders of this company, Theravance. And he was chairman of the board. So Roy called me and said, your reputation is pretty amazing as a drug developer. And we'd like for you to come in as one of the senior leaders to help us build this company from the ground as a drug discovery and development organization, basically to create a pharmaceutical company.
But how did you know Roy in the first place? If you didn't work at Merck, did you just somehow?
Oh, so Roy is a cardiologist by training. Roy is also an alumnus of the Mass General. He trained at the Mass General. And it's a small world. So Roy had come to the Mass General on a few occasions to give grand rounds, and he spent time with the Department of Cardiology. So he knew me through that connection, I think was the major connection. And then when I was doing well at Genentech, I think my reputation among the headhunters kind of began to grow. So I think he knew me from some direct interaction. We probably had a number of people who overlapped. And then I'm sure there were headhunters and other people also directing him to me.
But when you say that you were doing well at Genentech, what does that mean?
It means I was getting promoted a lot, and I was getting more and more responsibility, and I was getting it very quickly. I actually became the youngest vice president in the history of Genentech. Now, David Ebersman, who later became CFO, ended up eclipsing that. But at the time when I was made vice president, I'm fairly sure I was the youngest person to ever become a vice president.
Yeah. Okay. So Roy wanted you to come to Theravance to just oversee the pipeline, the development of the pipeline.
Yeah. It was a pretty early stage company when I went there. I think we had less than 20 employees, but we were very ambitious about our platform in chemistry, and we felt that platform could quickly produce best-in-class drugs in a variety of areas. So we were thinking very big, and I agree with Roy that if you're going to think very big, you need to get some high-level people to really help shape the strategy and the vision. I always say you develop drugs backwards. You have to have an understanding of what the market needs and how your product is going to be positioned in a market. And then you do the phase three to support that. You do the phase two to support the phase three, and the phase one, obviously, to support the phase one. So it's all about supporting the vision to get the drug to the market in the way that you want it. And that's really what I was hired to do, to basically come there and bring some commercial thinking early on and bring drug development thinking early on, trial design thinking, regulatory thinking. And it was a good fit. I was a good fit for them.
How long did you stay there?
I stayed there about 3 years, and I left when George Rathman, who I know you know, called me and said, I hear that you would make a good CEO, and I'd like to see if you'd be interested in taking a position where I would mentor you to be the CEO. And that was a terrific offer from George Rathman, not because of the company, by the way. The company had a lot of problems. The real magic here was being able to be mentored by George Rathman.
Yeah. One of the biotech's, you know, hallowed names as far as CEOs goes. Yeah,
absolutely.
So, but for you, that meant that not only you're going to oversee the pipeline and think about where drugs would fit in the marketplace, but now you have to manage people on top of that, the whole company, basically.
The whole
was
company.
Was that hard to figure out? How did you learn that?
I probably learned most about managing people at Genentech because, as I said, I got promoted there very quickly. When I went to Genentech day one, I had no employee. No, I managed no one. That was great because just managing myself was enough, and managing to really understand the environment. But I got promoted very quickly, so I began to take on managing people, and actually, I was fairly comfortable doing that because my view of it was just treat everyone the way I want to be treated, and it should work out okay. And I committed to doing that. And managing people, as you know, can be a challenge. But if you kind of keep yourself centered on doing the right thing, really just managing people the way you would want to be managed if the tables were reversed, it at least provides a nice framework.
But also, you know, you said before that you always acted authentically. And I think that really helps be a leader too. Do you agree with that? If you're acting authentically, then people will follow you.
I think that's absolutely right. In fact, what I've noticed in my career is that one of the things that happens with people is that if there's a void of information, they fill that void with something worse than the reality typically. So one of the things that's important as a leader is to provide clarity, to provide transparency, and to be honest. And I think you have to be honest when the news is good or bad. If you're only honest when the news is good, then quite frankly, you're not really being transparent.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So as you said, that was Nuvelo, right? And that company had some problems. Is that why you left?
No. I left. So when I went to the company, it was called HiSeq. It was a company that had been founded on some clever technology around sequencing DNA. That's the name HiSeq. It was hybridized-based sequencing. The company had gotten into the whole genomics space, and a little bit like the early Insight, they were trying to make a business out of that sequencing, but also a business out of SNPs. And neither of those businesses ultimately really, unfortunately, went very far. The reason the company did well, very well actually, was because George helped me to turn the company into a biotech company, much like Genentech. So we in-licensed a compound from Amgen, of all places, and that compound looked extremely exciting. And it made it all the way to phase three. And our market cap exceeded $1 billion, which was quite a lot of money back then. So
yeah,
it was doing extremely well. And then the drug failed in phase three, which shocked everyone. And of course, our market cap went down dramatically. And we merged the company with another company that needed the money that we had raised. And I went on the board of that new company. But the CEO of the other company, of course, I wanted him to continue to be the CEO of the merged company.
Yeah. I mean, that failure in phase three it's the story of biotech, really. I mean, how many drugs have looked great until something happens in phase three? It happens all the time. Yeah.
It happens. It happens all the time. And in retrospect, I understand the mistakes. I'm unlikely to make those mistakes again. But there are so many ways to fail, in drug development. Yeah. And my goal is to never make the same mistake twice. But this was one, quite frankly, where almost nobody saw it coming. Otherwise, the company wouldn't have been worth over $1 billion based on one product.
So then were you just kind of a free agent floating around then? How did you get to Onyx?
So I actually retired. So after this merger, it was very painful. It was extraordinarily painful. I'm not good at failure. I'm definitely not good at letting people down. I felt like I had let my employees down. I felt like I had let our investors down. I was, quite frankly, very depressed. And I had been fortunate that I had made enough money that I didn't really have to work to, pay bills and things. Uh-huh. So I just retired. I just said, I'll just sit on boards and I'll help people, but I'm not going to work full time anymore. And Tony called me up. Tony Coles was CEO of Onyx, and Tony and I've been friends since we were in college, actually. And he called me up and said, I really would love you to think about being our head of R&D. And I agreed to come out of retirement to lead the approval of a drug that they had just acquired for multiple myeloma. And I said, okay, I'll help get this drug approved. And after I get the drug approved, I'm going to retire again. But I will help this company get the drug approved. And we did.
Your first retirement there, why? Because you felt like, I don't want to put myself in a position to let people down again?
Yeah. Maybe I took the job too seriously. I mean, I'm not sure if I want to say that, but running a company and losing $1 billion of market cap and thinking about what that meant for the investor, running a company where you've got hundreds of employees and you have to reduce the company to essentially no employees. You think about what that means to people's lives. It was very difficult. And I was reluctant to put myself in a position to go through that again. I'm not bragging about this, by the way. You could call this, I just didn't want to get back on the bike. I had fallen.
I mean, looking back though, right, because we know that companies fail all the time and CEOs will jump right back up and do it again, almost like a badge of honor. Well, of course we fail. That's what a startup is, et cetera. It's good that Tony got you out of retirement.
Well, it worked out well for both of us. It worked out well for both of us. And you probably don't know this, but my mother died of multiple myeloma.
I did not know that.
And my mentor at Harvard, Ed Haber, died of multiple myeloma. So multiple myeloma was actually something that was somewhat personal for me. And I did feel like Onyx had a potentially very exciting drug that could be a breakthrough for these patients. And so I went into that job with a degree of desire to help the legacy of my mother and mentor.
I see. So if it had been if Tony was like, "Hey, we've got this great a drug for baldness," you would not have come out of retirement for that. It was
probably
that.
not baldness, probably not baldness, but I did do it significantly because of my relationship with Tony. And I think the way I approached the job was definitely driven by the passion to help myeloma patients.
So when Onyx is bought eventually, I think for 10 point something billion dollars is a Amgen bought it. Huge exit. And is that when you left?
I left before Amgen bought the company because, as I told Tony, I was simply there to get the drug approved. So literally, the day that the advisory committee said thumbs up, and the FDA said we're going to approve it, I retired. I
You were
retired
serious.
again. Yeah, I was serious, and we bought a home in the wine country. And we moved to the wine country.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, of course, that's not how it ends, right? You're up in the rolling hills of California working on your wine collection, I guess, but you're now the CEO of Global Blood Therapeutics. So how did you get back in the game?
Well, it's unlikely because I did go down this pathway of sitting on boards, and that was what I committed to. I really felt I could help CEOs, I could help management teams, I could help companies with my experience, and I didn't have to get back into the hot seat of being a CEO and the kind of commitment I knew that I would bring to that kind of job.
Yeah.
But what happened is Charles Holmesy, who is someone that I met for the first time when I was at the Mass General, he was a junior cardiologist when I went there as an intern and later as a cardiology fellow. And I had great admiration for Charles. And so we kind of had somewhat parallel careers because he left Harvard ultimately, came into industry. Charles called me up one day and said, look, we're starting this company based on sickle cell and we want you to run it. And I said, no, I said, I'm not going to come out of retirement this time, but I agreed to take a position on the board and to mentor the CEO and to help the company with its decisions at the board level. And over the course of about a year, two things were going on. One is every board meeting, they'd ask me to be the CEO. The second is that the science got more and more compelling for me. And one day, the scientists come in and they present data in the sickle mouse model, which is a very impressive model because basically sickle cell disease is a single defect.
Yeah.
On a single protein, and you can introduce that defect into mice, and you can make them essentially have sickle cell disease. And this particular compound essentially would begin to reverse the phenotype of sickle cell disease, literally within days of feeding the mice this compound. So I became convinced that this will help sickle cell patients if it's safe and well tolerated. And then I asked a series of questions about what I thought might give me a sense of whether this would be safe and well tolerated. And after I convinced myself that I thought this was the real deal, and I went back to Charles and I said, if you still want me to do this, I'm willing to discuss it with my family. And my family, my daughters actually said to me, you've got to do the step. This is something to help sickle cell patients. I know how you feel about sickle cell patients, and you're really extremely well qualified to do this better than anyone. So you got to do it. And that's how I came out of retirement. It was really a kind of a conflation of my desire to help sickle cell patients, knowing that 95% of them are African American. In the U.S., knowing how tragically, you know, their experience has been historically, having observed that firsthand as a physician at Yale and at Harvard later, and Charles Holmesy and my friendship with him, and quite frankly, my experience as a drug developer saying, I think this is a winner, and I think I can drive this winner to benefit the patient quickly. So I took the job really with that set of facts.
Yeah, I'd read, I mean, you told me before that you consider Global Blood Therapeutics in some ways to be almost a social justice company because, and you said this to me too, and I had not considered it. I mean, there are countless companies that are focused on cancer, Alzheimer's, you know, we've tried and failed dozens of times at that. But how many companies are actually focused on sickle cell? And it's almost none. And why is that?
Yeah, I think we're the only company that has taken this on, and I'm extraordinarily thrilled about it. Now there are other companies that are pursuing drugs in sickle cell disease now, for which I'm thrilled.
Yeah,
but I think we understand this disease better than anyone, and I think we are making compounds in our labs. In addition to Oxbryta, that's already out there treating patients, I think that this is going to be the sickle cell company one day. I'm quite convinced of that. I think we'll do other things down the road, but kind of like Gilead became the HIV company, I think GBT is going to be the sickle cell company. And that's a lot of work ahead of us.
I just had read one of these op-eds that you were part author on. Or one of the many authors on. And I want to touch on what you just said about when you were treating patients at Yale, that you had seen the way African-Americans were sort of, I guess, dismissed for, I don't know if you meant specifically this disease or just in general by the healthcare field. And can you give me more detail on that?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that our society, tragically, has racism fairly distributed. And I don't think doctors or nurses or any professional group for that matter is immune to what I would consider to be an infection that's rampant in our country. But sickle cell patients were particularly complicated because they have pain and you can't see pain. And they were often young because they died prematurely. So you didn't really have old sickle cell patients. Typically, they were young people, and they needed pain medication. So it was a setup for those patients to kind of develop a reputation of being something that they never were, which is drug seekers. They're seeking opiates. And that became the way a lot of us in medicine truly saw them. And it was tragically untrue. I mean, you do, I'm sure, have an occasional patient that is addicted or something.
Yeah.
But that's extraordinarily rare in sickle cell disease. Sickle cell patients, and now that I've gotten to know them very well, they don't want to go to the hospital. They don't want to interact with healthcare professionals. They don't want pain medication if they can manage themselves at home. So they really are only coming to the hospital when they are truly desperate, and then to be met by people that are so judgmental, negatively judgmental about them, is really kind of the final tragedy.
So they're coming in and they're giving this nebulous, I'm in pain.
Yes.
And doctors are like, listen, stop thinking about it. I don't know, take some aspirin, whatever, and dismissing them as opposed to actually finding out that they have sickle cell, or they know, they already know.
Oh, many times people know, although sickle cell is a relatively rare disease. And so many times when a sickle cell patient goes to an emergency room, they may actually interact with a physician that doesn't really know sickle cell very well.
Yeah.
And we as doctors are not very good at being vulnerable. So we don't tend to say, I don't know much about sickle cell disease. We tend to pretend that we know plenty. And oftentimes you have a sickle cell patient who knows more about sickle cell than the doctor does. And they know exactly how much morphine they require to really break their pain. And that is often a situation that makes people feel uncomfortable. I actually have a personal experience I can tell you about. When I was at the Mass General, my wife and I were out to dinner one evening, and she says, Ted, I think one side of your neck is much bigger than the other. And I replied to her that I had just noticed that my shirt size is increasing, and it had increased by almost an inch. And I looked carefully, and it, sure enough, I had a tumor. And I ended up, it fortunately ended up being a benign tumor, but it was an extremely complex operation that lasted for probably 8 hours or more.
To remove it.
And they ended up doing a lot of damage to my sympathetic plexus. And I was bleeding a lot after surgery. And I was in a lot of pain. And the doctor, before he left the hospital that night after the surgery, came to me. And I'm a physician. I'm a cardiologist. So he actually said, look, I have written a set of orders that basically puts you in charge. So you can get, you know, Percocet, you can get morphine. He kind of gave me the menu of what he had left. And of course, I didn't want anything. I wanted to, you know, I'm like a typical person that I don't want any medications if I can avoid it.
Yeah.
But as the night went on, I just got into terrible pain. I was bleeding and I was in terrible, terrible pain. So I rang the call bell and a young nurse came in and I told her exactly what I wanted in pain medicine. She almost fainted. She completely couldn't believe it. She pretty much ran out of the room. And I realized at that moment, I was like the sickle cell patient. But because I had a lot of medicine, I had a lot of expertise about what I wanted, and I knew what I needed, but she immediately thought I was a drug seeker. because I was black and I was young and I knew exactly what I wanted. And it didn't occur to her that maybe I'm a physician.
But she couldn't believe that you had this, your own ability to call in your own medication, or she couldn't believe that you knew exactly what you wanted? What was it that made her faint?
Oh, I think, well, first of all, it is unusual for a patient to
say, I
exactly,
need.
Yes. Could you give me 2 milligrams of ibuprofen? Yeah. That's unusual for a patient. So I understand that. But I actually suspect that had I been a white man, honestly, she might have said,
no problem.
No, well, maybe she would have at least said, are you a physician?
Oh, yeah. I see.
But she didn't do that. She ran out of the room. She just assumed that there's something bad here. And of course, there was nothing bad there. In fact, it was all good. I had probably resisted pain medicine as much as any normal person, maybe even abnormal person would. But how I was reacted to was really the story.
I see. She did not in her mind ever cross that you could be a physician.
No.
Because you're a young black man laying in bed. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I get it. You know, the last time I talked to you about this is about 3 years ago, and we were sort of talking about this disparity in biotech, this racial disparity. And I'm wondering if you've seen any progress in the past 3 years.
You know, I think I do. The whole George Floyd situation and what's going on in our country, while it's very painful and while it's very sad in a lot of ways, I see a lot of hope in this because I think, number one, people are realizing the magnitude of the problem. It's been apparent to people like me my whole life, but I can't fix it. The people who can fix it are suddenly, I think, aware of the magnitude of the problem. The other thing is you look at the protests, even the riots, the diversity of the crowd is very different from what it was when Martin Luther King was essentially saying the same thing. But I think we're at a point now where this problem is being embraced by all of us. It's not viewed as just their problem. Because as long as it's viewed as their problem, it's really never going to be fixed.
Right. Well, and why do you think, do you have an opinion of why that has suddenly clicked in place? Why George Floyd and not Tamir Rice? Why George Floyd and not Eric Garner?
You know, I don't know why Tamir Rice wouldn't have had the same effect, but I do think that it's probably a bit of our nation progressing. It may even be a little bit because of COVID. I think COVID was making us all kind of more emotionally vulnerable. And maybe being vulnerable, feeling vulnerable, allows you to connect in a different way when you see something so tragic.
Yeah.
And then finally, it was really a brutal murder with bare hands. It wasn't just a quick gunshot. It was literally, you know, 8 minutes and 46 seconds of collapsing someone's airway. So I think it may have been a combination of our country changing, our country being in a different spot because COVID, I think, was making us all much more pensive and thoughtful. And the nature of this just slow suffocation.
I agree with all that, right? And I think I'm working on this theory that there's one more element at play. And I'm basically talking about the white people who are protesting, especially the young white people who are protesting. It's almost as if like we've been 4 years into a very petty and mean-spirited presidential administration. I mean, it's divisive maybe isn't even a strong enough word, but there's been a lot of people who are not on his team, as I would say, who are just like finally like, screw this. Like everything came up in this moment and they're like, all right, this is it. We cannot take this anymore. All of it, George Floyd being the catalyst and race being the catalyst, but everything else that they've been building up with for 3 or 4 years, I think it all suddenly, they're just, we can't take this anymore. The country is coming apart and nobody's doing anything. What do you think of that theory?
I think it's a good theory. In fact, many people have said they felt the election of Trump was a backlash by
on Obama,
particularly on Obama. And Trump is dramatically more extreme, in my view, in terms of his policies and his rhetoric, in terms of what he stands for, than Obama. Obama was actually a fairly moderate president.
Me too.
But of course, in the eyes of some people, he was black, and that was a big problem.
Yeah, that was the most extreme thing to happen, is a black man was running the country, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Which is, so I do think that we very well may have a backlash, and I hope we do, to Trump, because Trump is, in fact, the direction of a decline of our country. I mean, if we want to become the next Nazi Germany, then that's where we're going. And I think a lot of people are saying, no, that's not what America is about. That's not what we're going to let ourselves become. I actually think that if we can get race is a social invention. I mean, there's no reason to group people by, there's no more rationale to group people by race than there is by height. Or by body weight. I mean, it's an invention that allows you to categorize people, unfortunately, around privilege. And it's kind of a silly invention, but it's so pervasive. And this has happened not only in the United States, right? It's happened all around the world. We do this with religion. We do it with race. We do it with social class. But these things are fundamentally devious when people start focusing on these things. It's really around disproportionately disproportionately rationalizing privilege. And I think what that does is it brings the whole society down. The performance of our country will do better if we get beyond this. And I think a lot of people understand that. All boats will rise, whereas hatred and discrimination is just going to hold the boat down and maldistribute the wealth. And there are those who are doing well in this maldistribution and may want to hold on to it. But I think a lot of us now are saying no more. It's just not morally acceptable to do this.
Yeah. I want to ask you this too. I this reminded me of you. Do you know, did you see the Kimberly Jones video that went viral? John Oliver had it on his show. This American Life just ran it at their podcast.
No, I have not seen it.
This is she's an African American woman, and she was giving this sort of started out as a sort of very direct explanation of why African Americans cannot win in this country, because they've been, all their money has been stolen from them for 400 years through slavery, and then even when you're given a little bit, they rig the game so that they constantly take money off. That she was using the Monopoly board to explain it. And at the end of it, she got very emotional, and it was a very powerful thing. That's why it went everywhere. But she said something in there about how even when you do let us in, there is psychological warfare where we're told that we're an equal opportunity hire. And that honestly made me think about that story you told me where you were at Haverford, and you were there was a discussion going on about Regents of the University of California versus Bakke. About affirmative action, and all your classmates, you guys have been discussing it. This was like in 1978, I think.
Yeah.
Your classmates were discussing it back and forth with you. You're part of the conversation. And a friend came up to you and said, you know, we've been hearing these conversations for weeks, and I think the winning arguments are made by Ted. And somebody said, oh, well, that's great until Ted takes your place in medical school.
Yep.
And this was this moment for you where you thought, oh, white people think that those are their slots, and the only way I get in is if I replace one of them, is if I don't earn it on my own.
Yep.
And that made me think of you. Like, what do you think of that concept of affirmative action? I mean, you could make the argument, and I would make the argument, that the only way you can really change a people is to legislate it. I mean, politicians have said that over and over. If you want to make a change that people are unwilling to do, you legislate it.
Yeah.
But so the concept of affirmative action happening, but how do you deal with this? I don't want to say it's psychological warfare, but the concept that maybe on both sides, that the only reason a person of color is there is because they have been plucked and they haven't earned it. It seems like a complex problem that I don't quite know how to deal with.
Well, a book that I'm about halfway through that I've been reading is How to Be an Anti-Racist. And I think that is a very, very thoughtful book. And it's really putting the focus on racist acts as opposed to having people try to focus on, am I racist or not? Because nobody wants to get into that discussion, right? About am I racist? And what he really makes the point very clear is that all of us have advertently or inadvertently supported racist things, whether it be policies or behaviors. I mean, I'll give you an example for me. This is a very soft example, but and I could probably come up with bigger ones. But I'm a season ticket holder to the San Francisco 49ers. And I watched the NFL emasculate Colin Kaepernick, and I've continued to pay thousands and thousands of dollars a year to the NFL.
That ticket, yeah.
And what I'm really doing is I've been supporting clearly a lot of racist behavior. And I'm clear, but I'm clear to say that. I think there are many African Americans who have supported bigger police departments to deal with crime. Now, they haven't typically done it as the only solution, but in fact, I think in retrospect, even Bill Clinton would say a lot of the things that they did accelerated the dramatic and inappropriate incarceration of people of color.
Yeah.
Those were racist policies. And so this book allows us to step back and say, until we have essentially random distribution of wealth, resources, opportunities, there's racism because there will be random distribution. Racism was invented to actually, the focus on race was invented to do this. And so it's no surprising that it's so good at. And so the only way you are really solving racism is the numbers have to change. The numbers have to change. And until they change, then you are dealing in an environment where racism is prevalent. And that's the US. And I think that we're starting to get there. I was telling people that I think this term quota is I viewed it in my career as a very charged term.
Yeah.
Because we bring up quotas when we don't want to do something. When we do want to do it, we call them goals. So I'll give you an example. We, like most commercial companies, have a sales force, and we have to compensate them based on their performance. So we literally count the number of bottles that are sold. We don't call those quotas, we call those goals.
Yeah.
Why isn't your bottle a quota? The reason why it's not, we don't call it a quota, is that we don't want to stigmatize the bottle sold as negative. So I think the whole language really does position things to be embraced or not embraced. And I actually think quota is a very negatively charged word. Affirmative action got to be negatively charged. But in fact, we've had quotas for hundreds of years in this country, I tell people all the time. And the quota for someone that looks like me was zero.
Yeah. The quota thing, right. So as soon as you said it, I thought, oh yeah, I've heard that before. Hey, well, now you're talking about a quota. We're not going to do that. That somehow forces companies to hire the wrong person. You need the best person for companies to survive because companies are cutthroat, et cetera. But I think quota, for white people anyway, it's so charged because that suddenly directly attacks them, meaning I could lose my job.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you want to do it, I think it's got to be legislated. I don't know.
I think you're right. And quite frankly, the thing that we all need to understand is that we should all be working to get the best people in the right positions. I do think that it's fair that I had to work hard to get into medical school. But I also think that that making the environment at every step along the way harder for me to get there wasn't fair. I was able to overcome that, but many people cannot overcome that.
But you said this thing too earlier. as you said, you learn this in wrestling. You never give up. Ted Love does not give up, right? Which means that Ted Love has the life that he has now. But what about people who are, you know, 90% of your capabilities and intelligence, but they don't have quite the strong will? Like, we can't make it impossible for them to succeed. And when you look at the things that you've done, you had to overcome the race difference between where you grew up and then Haverford, the class difference, the first to college, you know, all those things, that, all those little barriers you had to jump through. A lesser person wouldn't have made it. And that does not seem right.
It does not seem right. And I can tell you, I grew up with kids that were at least as smart as I was. And they had very different paths. And the question becomes, why did they have very different paths? Now, some of it is chance. There's no doubt about that. But I think a lot of it was my family structure was able to recharge me and to keep me going. I think that if I had not had a stable family environment, I would not have turned out the way I turned out. So that's where this criminal justice system is really, really, really exacerbating the problem. When you take a Black man at such high rate and you incarcerate them, when you have the criminal system interacting with them so readily, I mean, the George Floyd thing, he should never even, I mean, it was not even an arrestable event, really. Even the thing in Atlanta recently, I mean, the guy was asleep in
Richard,
his car.
Yeah.
How do you go from being asleep in your car to being killed?
I mean, George Floyd, none of them should have died. The police are militarized to their teeth and they shoot everything, right? That's the problem, right? And I'm not even, you know, I don't know what it's like to be a cop. Maybe I'd be terrified I'm going to get killed every day. I don't know. But
one of the things to keep in mind is that I believe this statistic is right, but I know it's something of this attitude. Every time a policeman shoots one white person, kills one white person, they kill 22 people of color. 22. The distribution is just so out of proportion.
So the Washington Post started to track all police killings. Mm-hmm. And the sheer number of people that are killed by police, more whites are killed by police than blacks because there's more whites in this country. But they shoot more blacks by percentage. Like, if blacks are 13% of the country, 26% of the people shot by police are black, which tells
you
that's the number, right? So that's the double of the population in the country. Like, why is that? That's where you start to go, there's a problem here with the way police perceive black people. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't know where I was going with that. Maybe no place.
Yeah, no. But I mean, these are startling things. I mean, I do wonder, had that guy been asleep in his car, had he been a white person, would the person even have called the police?
Yeah.
Would they have viewed him as dangerous?
Yeah.
I can tell you, I was driving, you know, we live in Sonoma most of the time. We have a house in the city, and I had an early meeting in the city yesterday. So I came into the city early. I came into the city late the evening before last. And as I was driving up Van Ness, I saw a man, happens to be a white man, probably in his 30s, looking very panicked and literally running on 101 on Van Ness. And I was in my car with my roof down, and I couldn't leave him. And suddenly he ran over to me and he said, you know, I just came down and my car was running and I'm panicked. I think somebody's trying to hurt me. And I was very concerned about it. So I spent time with that guy and I said, call the police, I will not leave you. I think I would have done that for a black person or a white person. But yeah. I would say in this country that had that been and it turns out, I think the guy was having a paranoid breakdown. I don't think there was anybody after. I don't think his car was running. I think it was all in his head. He later began to show me. So he actually literally jumped in my car. My roof was down. He literally jumped in my car. I didn't hit him. I didn't call the police. I didn't shoot him. I didn't want any harm to come to him. I felt like he was a person that needed some help. And I think unfortunately, in this country, if you're a black male, particularly, that is not the reaction that you get.
Oh, 100% agreed. Yeah. Oh, I thought you were going to tell me he called the police. They came and tried to arrest you. That's how I thought that story was going to end.
Well, you know, I mean, one of the things that people like me worry about is that they show up and they may think I'm a threat to him, even though I'm just there trying to help him. And that's happened, as you know, that's made the media before, where black people have intervened in situations to try to help and the police show up and start shooting and they shoot the black person that's trying to help.
Yeah. My wife and I are talking about George Floyd. Absolutely. If that had been me, I would not have been killed. They would not have ground a knee into my neck until my esophagus collapsed and died. I feel 100% sure on that. Rayshard Brooks, you know, I don't know if they would have killed me for that. It's hard to say, but George Floyd, absolutely not. Tamir Rice, absolutely not. I mean, you can just go through the line.
And the truth is nobody should be killed for these things.
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, I was born in this country. I'm an American. I'm proud of a lot of things America's done, but sort of in my darker moments, I think, are we like a failed experiment? I mean, sometimes maybe the melting pot isn't quite the thing we think it is. And are the original sins of this country, genocide against Native Americans and then slavery, and then capitalism, although it drives innovation and fills the marketplace, it grinds down the poor.
Yeah.
And we have this like freedom of speech, which is awesome, except that it allows people to get online and say the most hateful things and collect in little hateful units. And then we have this sort of fatal flaw in our Constitution that sort of allows any idiot to carry an automatic weapon around. And I'm like, maybe this whole thing is going to come crashing down. I don't know.
Well, I worry about all the things that you worry about. You know, I am reminded that Hitler did something that really the world should never forget. And almost everything that he learned about superior of one race over the other based on genes was really based on American publications. You know, we actually, in many ways, were responsible for Hitler's thinking. And the other ironic thing about Hitler is that I don't think he ever won the election. He got all of his power without ever winning an election. And I don't want to lose the parallel there. But sometimes people can amass enormous power. And then suddenly you have a country that's completely lost. I mean, I don't think the majority of Germans actually wanted to have what happened to Jews happen. I think many of them were kept ignorant of what was really going on.
Yeah. And then the fear thing starts playing out.
If they
speak up, what happens to them, kind of thing. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, my wife is Chinese, and we were watching a news piece yesterday, and there was a Japanese woman in San Mateo County, which is where we used to live when we lived on the peninsula, who was saying that so many of the Japanese had been interned here in America during World War II. And they have that harmful memory about race and how it can hurt you. But when it comes to discrimination against African Americans, they've kind of sided with white people because they don't want to put themselves in play to be the target. It was a very interesting admission that you made, that there's kind of, to your point, there's kind of this fear if you don't go along. And I think that's exactly what was operative in Germany. And I think that's been operative with many groups of individuals historically.
Which tells you, you know, that it's human nature. It's the self-preservation instinct, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have one more thing I want to ask you, and I don't know that you have an answer to this, but when you sort of look at what you call this George Floyd catharsis almost, and I'm wondering if there's sort of one thing where whites look at it one way and blacks are looking at it another way, and we're not seeing eye to eye on it.
Well, I mean, there was a line that I've used a lot in my life as a leader. I really start to use this line a lot when I was at Genentech. And the line is, where you stand often depends on where you sit. There's no doubt true. And that's one of the reasons that diversity is so important, is that diversity allows you to get beyond the myopia of what an individual can see and appreciate based on their background, their experiences. So diversity allows you to get beyond that and have a team, have an organization, which is much more broad and can be much more strategic about dealing with issues by covering every avenue. So, yeah. So I think that's, you know, got to be true that you're going to be somewhat influenced by your perspective. But I also think that there's a lot of common ground here. And if we focus on the common ground, that's where you can move things forward. So I think in general, no good police believes killing people is appropriate. Now, this country has had many KKKs. And, you know, we have a history in our country of KKKs being chief of police. So those are individuals who are not really embracing fundamentally what police say they're supposed to be doing. They're people who got these jobs. So I think if we really have police focusing on what police should focus on, there's a lot of common ground here. We all want to feel protected, but the truth is that I'm mostly nervous that I'm going to get the short end of the stick when I know police. And I pay a lot more taxes than most Americans. So yeah. I'm funding this, and it's not right. So we need to focus on the common ground, and we need to focus on fundamental issues and get beyond these superficial things, which are holding us back. Race is fundamentally a superficial issue in the very beginning.
Yeah, it's a construct, right?
It's a construct that was man created for devious reasons, and the world needs to pull out of it and just say, you know, I don't care if you're black. I mean, my wife is Chinese, and I can tell you, I had a lot of issues about not marrying a black person. I had a lot of issues.
You mean from your family?
Well, from me personally. I mean, let alone my family. It was just, you know, am I doing something wrong? Am I betraying, or, you know, and it's silly. You know, you just find the person that's authentic to you and helps you and you love and get on with it and don't care about it. But in this society, it's very hard to do that because we're very caught into it.
I this is many years ago, but I was in this class and I said, we were talking about race and sports, I think, or something. And I said, you know, kind of my hope is that we just all keep intermarriage and intermingling, and eventually we're all sort of like one sort of creamy color. And this woman, a black woman, is like, it'll be something else. If it's not that, it'll be something else to divide us up. And that's a depressing thought, but I don't know. Maybe that's true. I don't know.
It is the history of the world, right?
In
India, it's about caste. In some countries, it's about your religion. And unfortunately, it's the nature of humans to try to figure out a way to get an advantage, to define why I'm intrinsically better than you. And I think it's a false, it's a false process that takes us all down. And we have to push against it, because I do think that she's got a good point that historically we've shown a propensity to go toward this.
Yeah. Good talk, Ted.
No, it's a great talk. I'm thrilled that you're doing it. I think the more conversations that we have are going to point out how we're all the same. And if we all are focused on helping each other, loving each other, supporting each other, all the boats will rise, crime will fall, fear will fall, happiness will increase.
Utopia.
And we'll have a better place. Yeah. We're going in the opposite of utopia right now. I'd like to get us charged in running toward it.
Yep. Agreed. Okay. Thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it, Ted. I will hold on. I'm going to stop this recording. Okay. That is it. The end of the First Rounders podcast with Ted Love. Thank you, Ted. I feel a little better. I feel like that conversation was useful. I think maybe something good will happen through all this. I think we have felt that before in this country, that we've reached a tipping point and things are going to get better. And then we have seen that that is not the case, or that the change is incremental. But I'm going to cross my fingers this time and keep doing what I can. So thank you to the Midwest Quiet for use of their music in this podcast. If you'd like to find us on Twitter, our handle is @NatureBiotech. You can speak to us about this podcast, forum, our other podcast, or anything else that the Journal does. What else? Yeah, there's another one coming. It's in the can already. I recorded it. It's ready to go. It'll be out July 1st. I'll even tell you who it is. Katrine Bosley. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, y'all. Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.